everybody. I'm Beatty Covretos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beatty Show. And I was thinking as I was walking around rainy New York City today that I've been hosting the Ask Beatty Show now for over 10 years. And every single time I do the show, I hope that there is some small little thing, some small takeaway that will actually help you to feel happier, to feel freer, to feel more connected to yourself and to others in your life. And for those of you who are actually tuning in for the very first time and you're wondering who is Beatty Covretos, well, I am a psychotherapist and a sex therapist. I am also the author of the groundbreaking book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And I say it every week, it certainly is a book that I wish I had had when I was starting in my own romantic and dating love life many, many years ago. But again, the show, and the reason why I really love to do the show is about empowerment. We talk about all of the things, and of course, there are many things that we can actually do, not just think about, not just dream about, to improve the quality of our lives and our relationships. So, of course, we talk about mental health issues and sexuality and relationships. And again, what we need to do, what actions we actually need to take. And for each of us, our actions may be very, very different to maximize our physical, our emotional, our psychological, our sexual well-being, despite the stressors of life. And of course, we all understand that there is nothing we can do in terms of being able to change our history. And I have a mantra. I have a mantra that I hope that I have been able to convince you to also embrace. And that mantra is to be willing to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we can. And this takes a lot of introspection. It takes a lot of honesty. The things that continue to get in the way of our lives and our relationships so that we can be free, so that we can be happier, that we can live a much more joyful life. Because, you know, you look at the statistics and people, 29% of adults are talking about experiencing clinical depression. We're looking at depression amongst young people. I've been consulting in a high school in East Hampton for the last year. And, you know, who would have ever dreamed that suicide is the second leading cause of death in the world for those ages 15 to 24? We're looking at divorce rates, 48% for first marriages, 67% of couples who are hopeful and in love and are wanting the outcome to really work out. 67% of these second marriages also end in divorce. And what about third marriages? And people are always surprised to hear me, I think, even ask the question. And for third marriages, we're looking between 71 and 73% of couples who are marrying for the third time end up in front of a judge in the divorce court. And yet there's so many articles on happiness and what we're supposed to be doing to live a happier and more joyful life. And yet, what is it? What is it that is going on? Why is it that we seem for such a long, long period of time, and this is pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, that we can't seem to get ourselves on a reasonably even keel, even though, of course, an even keel is something that changes probably, if not every day, then every couple of days. Now, my producers this morning, they sent me an email and they wanted to know whether I was going to be hosting the show today because it is Yom Kippur. And I grew up Orthodox in a Orthodox Canadian family. And of course, for Yom Kippur, we're looking at our life in the past year, whether or not we were, you know, behaving well, whether or not we were a good person, whether or not we were virtuous. And just before the show began, I was listening to a good friend of my husband and mine, Cornel West, who of course is running for president of the United States right now. And he was a speaker at Rabbi Michael Lerner's Beit Tikkun services this afternoon. And again, you know, he was talking about the importance of being virtuous, the importance of love, the importance of goodness. And I wanted to do the show today, particularly because I wanted to meet Jameson Webster, because on August 27th of this year, there was not a one page in the New York Times, but there were two pages of her opinion piece, The Case Against Being a Good Person. And I thought, what a perfect day it would be today to have Jameson Webster, you know, on the show to talk about all of this. So, Jameson, I want to welcome you. I know you're in Cyprus. Jameson is a clinical psychologist and a psychoanalyst and a professor at the New School here in New York City. And she is the author most recently of Disorganization and Sex. So welcome, welcome. It is so nice to meet you.
Hello.
Hello. We have to meet when you get back to New York. So listen, this case against being a good person and the virtues of being bad in the context of what Cornell was just talking about and Michael Lerner was talking about. Let my audience know some of your thoughts, because I read the article and reread the article several times, and you're making some really interesting points about some of the pitfalls of our always feeling that we need to behave and be, you know, the good person in quotes. So what is this all about?
But, you know, it's funny because you don't get to title your own articles at the New York Times. Some people don't know that. So, you know, it's a very start out with the idea. Me and my editor, Max Strasser, he said, I want to do a kind of end of the summer roundup. And they asked all these people to kind of confess their transgressions. But he said, you know, in the current environment, the value of being bad or being sloppy or being messy or, you know, really kind of the ways in which we don't live up to standards, he said, I want to do a piece on that. And I was really happy to do it. Been something that my colleagues and I had talked about, which is just that a lot of patients at this point come in talking about the advice that they're given and all be a good person, and really difficult to get underneath so that you can evaluate it reasonably, you know, whether it's bad or good for them, or even if it's bad, you know, what could be interesting about it or what are their fantasies about it, that it feels really hard to dig down underneath that. And so it was really about the kind of layers and layers and layers of advice, especially on TikTok and on Instagram, that are seeding into this. And I think there is a current environment of piousness and sanctity and rules, and which I think is a response to something that's going on socially. You alluded to this, the suicide rates are off the charts. It's insane. Depression, yes. Divorce, confusion about relationships, our bonds and our sense of community is shredded. And we have people in power who don't follow rules. Right. So I think almost on a personal level, the rules and the structure that's not in place is being imposed on an individual level. And that's not the way it works. What you need is a good society that acts as a container that then allows the individual to wrestle with themselves and wrestle with their desires and try to figure out what their place and passions are in the world. So it's as if we've turned completely upside down.
Right. No, it's true. And I'm no fan of, I have to tell you, of American mental health. And of course, I'm Canadian and did all of my training and postgraduate training at McGill. And all of this so-called advice Jameson, and all of the coaches and all of the therapists and all of these people who are dishing out at times some of the most absurd, destructive, self-destructive advice. And I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, people are they're so confused. Is it A, is it B, is it a combination? And I mean, when I look about at the, you know, the situation that's going on in this country with marriage. And it would be interesting to have, you know, a chit chat with you right now. I'm very clear on why people, whether or not you're talking about marriage or you know, healthy relationships, why we're having difficulties, the kinds of difficulties that we are. I mean, I've identified three things, and I'm curious what your response would be. I mean, number one, if each of us is not in a reasonably good place, emotionally, psychologically, psychiatrically, and if we're looking for somebody to save us, you know, the damsel in distress or the male in distress, it's not going to happen. And so we don't hear a lot about people needing to really get their act together in order to be able to find and maintain a healthy relationship with anyone. And what I've also found is that people, and I think that we may have lost Jameson for the moment, what I've also found is that people, despite all of the TikTok and all of the advice columns, are still really unclear about the ingredients that go into a long-term healthy relationship. And number three, you know, we assess everything in our lives. And yet when it comes to our relationships, I suppose it's because of our neediness and our wanting to have a relationship and our wanting to be in love and to have somebody love us, that we don't take the time, because we really don't know the ingredients that go into a long-term healthy relationship, to really accurately assess who somebody is and who somebody is not. And, you know, before I did my research and before I did the book For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, I would meet someone. I would meet a man, I would meet a woman, and my comment would be something like, "Oh, what a nice person." I mean, I would never, ever, ever make that kind of comment or give that kind of commentary today. The best that I would say, and I've taught my patients, hopefully, to do the same, you know, what I say is that I have met somebody who appears to be, you know, nice and trustworthy. And what my research found is that it takes about a year to really find out who somebody is and is not. So we know, if we're looking at the world of relationships, people are so upset and they're so disappointed. And of course, virtually everybody that I know, my patients and my friends, are on the dating sites. And for most, I have to say, it is so depressing for them. They will reach out and hoping that there is going to be perhaps an initial connection. And yet that is not typically what's happening. Before people, you know, even engage in some initial, hopefully meaningful conversation, they find that they're ghosted, they are not liked, and they are left feeling sad and depressed and rejected. And it's interesting, I treat a couple of young men who live in Chicago, and they are in one is in his mid-20s, the other is close to 30, and we were looking to see how many in-person singles, events there were. Now, we know Chicago is a really big city, right? And we could hardly find anything. Because what's happened, of course, is that the majority of connections and the majority of interactions continue to be online. And by the way, my guest, Jameson Webster, who's the clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst who I was hoping to be able to interview about her really interesting piece that appeared in the New York Times, Jameson is in Cyprus right now, and I am not at all sure what has happened with the connection. But what I want to do is read a couple of paragraphs from her article, and then hopefully we can talk about it. And then if you have some comments, you could always call me live. The show is live right now at 888-874-4888. And this is what Jameson Webster says. She says, there is no end of advice these days on how to be a good person, how to make good decisions, how to be mindful and compassionate, how to have boundaries, how to be open, how to be assertive, how to not be self-effacing, and how to be politically invested, and how to live in the now. Oh, you're back, Jameson. I'm not sure what happened.
I don't know what happened.
Listen, you're in Cyprus. I'm in New York City. Things happen. And I'm really glad that you are back. I'm trying to remember where we actually...
You're telling me there are three reasons that people are getting divorced. And the first was you have to be in a good emotional place. And then I was waiting in the Zoom. So you can...
And you were waiting in... And secondly, you know, despite all the relationship books and the TikTok and everything that we're hearing online, I mean, what I find is that people are still unclear about the ingredients that really need to go into a successful relationship, whether or not you're married, whether or not you want to date, whether or not you're living together. There isn't that kind of clarity. There's a lot of confusion. And I mean, do you find that to be the case too in your private practice?
I do. I think social media, I mean, we know, for example, very clearly that it's making young girls not only depressed but suicidal.
Yes.
We don't know what it is about it, but we know that they're particularly vulnerable to whatever is going on social media.
Right.
And I don't think that it's just cyberbullying. I think it's everything that they're looking at that's completely confusing. And, you know, if you look, you know, it's hard to understand what's going on, but we just didn't have access to all this information, to all these images, to all these contradictions.
Right.
It took a lot of time as a young adult getting to know life. And now
right.
It's as if all the things that you might find out in your 20s or you might find out in your 30s flood the person from the minute that they enter into the world of the internet. And it's not just them, it's their parents.
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, yeah. Yeah.
There's so much confusion, as you say. You know, when you were just getting back on Zoom, I was mentioning how I treat a couple of young men, one in his mid-20s, one who's close to 30 in Chicago, and they're single. And of course, you know, the 2-year pandemic, and one works from home full time, so there isn't that, you know, day-to-day person-to-person connection. So we were looking last week, each of them, during our session, to see what kind of in-person events, right, for single people are there in a huge city like we could hardly find anything, Jameson. It was amazing. And they have not had success online. And despite the fact that they were waiting for likes or they were waiting for matches, it was not happening. And I'm seeing the same thing with my own patients here in New York, whether or not they're 30 or 50 or 60 or whatever age. It's not really happening. And you're right. We're seeing more and more depression with younger people, more and more just, I'm giving up, mm-hmm. you know. And yeah, so you're seeing the same thing.
Yeah, I think it's even worse than that. I think especially with the online dating, people are actually really quite injured deep down.
Yes.
Because you meet all these people and they all kind of reject each other. And,
right.
You know, you have these ways of saying, well, I didn't care and I don't know who they are, but it's abrasive. It's cruel.
Right.
And, you know, they ghost you or they stop texting you back or you meet and they give you 10 minutes and then they cancel the date because they have
right.
three or four lined up. And people don't hold to meetings anymore because they're seeing, you know, 25 people or something like this. They're talking to 25 people by text. And I've watched over the last, I don't know how many years, 10 years, an accrual of injury and cynicism, and it breaks my heart.
Yes. Now, I don't know what you're
and
seeing.
Nobody knows what to do. Nobody knows.
Right. You know, when you talk about sex, what I'm also hearing and what I'm also seeing is that people are having much less sex than ever before. I mean, this is the experience that I'm experiencing with my patients and also with friends. And what's happened to this desire that you write about and that it's hot and it's fun? And now we are so concerned now with the technique. And am I orgasming enough? And am I wet enough? And is he hot enough? And is my body beautiful enough? And I'm just seeing a lot less satisfaction sexually as well.
Oh, I really agree with you. I mean, all the satisfaction in a way is the negative satisfaction of the phone. I mean, you know, yes. people know that they're spending between 3 to 6 hours on the phone. Right. I mean, that's 3 to 6 hours that you could be passionate and fucking and I don't know, but right. You're 3 to 6 hours on the phone, and when you're done, you feel right. Terrible. The last thing you're going to do is have sex. So no, sex is seemingly going more and more out the window. I mean, there's fascinating statistics about this, you know, as if in Japan, they're paying people to have children, and 56% of the population say they're disgusted with sexuality. You know, in Japan's its own case, right. But it seems as if, you know, an extreme case tells you something about the rest of the global population. And you know, I saw teenagers, let's say 20 years ago, and it's the time of great exploration. It is not the time of great exploration anymore, except for I still do believe that really, really good psychoanalytic, psychotherapeutic work, you know, you watch people open up and you watch it blossom and you watch this whole dimension appear that otherwise wouldn't have been there. And then you think, good God, what if you hadn't have done this for them? What if they had stayed so shut down, so mired in themselves, so confused, so defensive, so guarded, you know, so in the enjoyment of the internet and the endless looking and the endless, you know, I don't know, whatever people do online. And I watched the work, or at least the therapeutic work, create a separation there from what's actually not so great in a life.
No, exactly. Exactly. You know, in your article, there was, you know, a little paragraph written by Lauren Huff about doing drugs. What are you finding? Are you finding that your patients are experimenting and are interested in the whole psychedelic scene? Because I'm starting to hear more and more of this from people in their 30s and 40s and basically all ages. There's a curiosity about this. So what are you finding?
There's definitely a curiosity about it. I mean, I think that we've reached a kind of, we had reached a maximal situation with the psychopharmacological solution. And, you know, science is interesting insofar as, you know, the serotonin hypothesis in a way is being displaced because they're looking at hormones and they're looking at gut biomes and they're realizing that it's not all just synapses and serotonin and dopamine receptors.
Right.
And, you know, this experiment that began in the 80s, we're now 50 years in. They never intended for everyone to be on lifetime's worth of drugs. And we're seeing now what lifetime worth of psychopharm has done or not done.
Right.
And I think people want something else very badly. You know, does it always have to be drugs? No, I kind of prefer talking.
Right.
Talking, sex also. And then maybe some hallucinogens. But it's the whole question of the microdosing.
Right. Some of the basic things, you know, I did an article. I am the advice columnist for Dan's Papers in the Hamptons and Palm Beach, a couple of other places. And I was looking at different societies around the world. So my last article addressed the blue zone, what are people doing, you know, in the blue zones, in the Nordic countries, where the happiness scale levels are a lot higher, or so the people are saying that they're higher than in the United States or in other parts of Western Europe. And it's basic. They get up, there's a connection, there's socialization, they nap, they eat healthily. It's pretty simple. Now, never having lived there, I don't know exactly, you know, what the reality is, but the studies seem to be pretty consistent in their findings of the happiest people in the happiest societies are doing very, very specific, simple kinds of things. And they're probably not on their phone 6 or 9 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Well, they also have security. They have some kind of sense that, you know, should you get sick, should yes. something happen to you, there's a safety net.
Yes.
They have free education, so they're not yep. in massive amounts of debt. I think that this, you know, obviously is huge because, you know, in America, I think people feel as if you can drop away. You know, all of the articles that we read, for example, about people dying of fentanyl, the levels of homelessness, it's a fantasy in many of my patients' head that you screw up your life and then you will become that. You know, there's nothing to save you. There's nothing to hold you. You could become a homeless person, on, you know, miserable and on drugs. Like all yeah. of it. Hold people. It doesn't give you a feeling of security or a feeling of safety.
No, it's true. I mean, I'm Canadian, you know, born, raised, educated in Canada. And when I think about what I paid to go to graduate and my postgraduate work at McGill, I mean, it was $450 a semester. And I think now it's a few thousand. Okay, not so terrible, but it's not 50,000. And you don't come out of, you know, a 4-year college experience where you are in debt. And just today, Jameson, I had to have a prescription filled, actually, you know, for Retin-A. So I went to CVS, and there was some confusion about my doctor who hadn't contacted the insurance company. So I asked, you know, so what is the cost of this tube of Retin-A? And it was something like $450 or, you know, close to $500. So, of course, I went to my Canadian pharmacy world, the kinder, gentler world, and I think it was like $49. So I had the pharmacist, you know, just fax over the prescription. So these kinds of things, of course, you know, what you're talking about, I mean, they really impact us. You know, and the things that so many Americans are having to deal with, people in the kinder, gentler world and societies, it's a different ballgame. Now you're in Cyprus right now. Are you on vacation or are you lecturing? Are you planning to stay? How did you get to Cyprus?
Oh, it's a good question. Actually, I was helping organize a conference that we just finished the other day on borders, frontiers, boundaries, uh-huh. and for psychoanalysts.
Yeah.
But we did it specifically in that's divided capital in the globe. So Turkey invaded Cyprus. I mean, the Turkish would probably say otherwise, but from the Greek Cypriot side, Turkey invaded. And there's a hard border in the country. You have to pass a UN buffer zone. So in addition to the conference where we talked about patients and we talked about the question of how we think about the frontiers and boundaries of the mind or between people, we went and visited this border. And it's wild. I mean, the country is behind barbed wire. There's a UN buffer zone. They just basically knocked out huge neighborhoods in order to create it. And the population had to divide in half. You either had to go to Turkey or you had to go to Greek Cyprus. So I, you know, we had planned this idea, but to actually see it in person was striking. You know, and there was a moment when I went through a British base. It's even worse. The British gave the country back at a certain point in time, but they kept two military bases. And I've never seen more barbed wire fences in my life. At which point it opened up to the most beautiful beach you've ever seen in your life.
Uh-huh.
And I jump off the bus into this beautiful blue water, although it was behind barbed wire. And you thought, what is wrong with people?
Right.
Like, look at what you've done to this landscape. And it really is a metaphor for the mind, what you cordon off, what you put behind the bars, what you won't let yourself access.
Yes.
Why you divided yourself in half. You know, what are the circumstances of your life that made you not want to recognize a huge part of yourself? And so that's why I'm here.
So you're going to be are you going to be staying for some time or what?
No, we're here just for a few more days to enjoy ourselves after 4 days of conference, and then I'll be back.
And then you'll be back in New York. I'm really interested about your book. I haven't read it yet, but I will. Disorganization and Sex. So I want my audience to hear about the book and know about the book and buy the book and let us know what the book is about.
It's a book that's a collection of essays. Some are very scholarly and academic, and some are more popular writing, like I do for the New York Times or the New York Review of Books. So it's a mixture, and then there's some case studies and clinical examples. But the publishers had gathered a lot of my work over the last 13 years, and they said, "Hey, you know, you really have a coherent theme." And I said, "Do I?" And they said, "No, it's really important to you that there's something about the mind, about the psyche, that the forces at work, you know, want to express themselves, and they don't let you clamp down too hard." And they said, "You're very interested in this, and you're not just interested inside an individual person, but between people. How do we disorganize each other? How do we unsettle each other? What are the forces that are at work between two people when they're in love or when they're passionate? And then also within institutions, you know, that there's something important that an institution not become too calcified, that it not become too rigid, that it be open to change with the times, that it listen to what's going on. And that there be some sort of force that disorganizes it from within." And it's also a very basic Freudian idea about the drive. You know, we have these sexual drives.
Yes.
And they don't leave us alone. They'll never leave you alone. You know, to be left alone by your sexual drive is to be dead. So being alive is very hard, though, because of this. But we have to kind of embrace the force, the disorganization, the being unsettled, the intensity, the desire for more, and how difficult it is to be satisfied with what we have.
Yes, and I'm hearing, you know, as I was mentioning before, is that people are having a lot less sex. Yes. I mean, are you finding that as well? I mean, even with the younger patients that you are working with,
and you feel so unsettled, and sex is disorganizing, let's say, if it's intense, right, disorganizing, then you can't open yourself up to that.
Right.
I think that's part of the fact that it's happening less. They don't want to do it. They don't want the intimacy. It's too scary. It's too frightening. It's too unsettling, especially at that age. It's intense.
Right.
And I really do find that they're at the younger generation, whatever it is, they're not the sex, drugs, rock and roll. They're alone in their rooms on their phones, and this is safe.
Yes, exactly. And you know, since so many people, and I'm surprised. I mean, in the last even year, I'm surprised at how many people are still working from home. On all levels. So there is this kind of Zoom interaction, which is fine for us for an hour. But I mean, there are people who really never see anybody. Yeah. And when they do see people face to face, are really unsure about how to communicate and how to connect and what should I say and what should I wear. I mean, I'll see people on Zoom, and in my practice in New York City, I had hoped that after, you know, the pandemic, even though the numbers, by the way, are ticking up, and my office is in our apartment on the Upper West Side, and I'm starting to see more and more people wearing masks, and the statistics are a little worrisome, right now. But in the last year and a half, I would say that 90% of the people that I am seeing in New York City do not want to come in and they are still on Zoom. I have a woman and I tell the story. She lives one block away, and she will not walk over. And people are in their pajamas. People are not getting dressed. And these are, in quotes, you know, educated, in quotes, successful, so-called educated types. And their comfort level is being on Zoom, being on the computer. And no matter. Yeah. What about with your practice? Are people actually coming in person to your office to see you face to face?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm a bit authoritarian or something. It's like you either come or I won't see you.
I think that's good. I actually think that's really a good thing.
Yeah, I did the year or whatever it was during the pandemic until I went back to my office as quickly as possible. I couldn't stand the Zoom, and I didn't think that the seriousness with which I treat the sessions was possible when the person was clearly looking at their text messages.
Absolutely.
Clearly had just flicked me in from the other meeting. It cannot work like this.
I'm with you.
It would be much more convenient for me.
It would be great. I would be at my never go to my office again. But I take the work seriously, and I don't think that it's good for the patient. So I'm very strong about that rule. And I don't hear in my patients that it's good for them to be working at home.
Exactly. It's not.
I don't actually think it's good for the companies. They don't care about their fellow employees anymore.
Right.
And socially, what you were talking about the fact that nobody knows even how to speak to each other. I mean, I think we really don't, we haven't quite grasped, and we still don't understand what effect the pandemic had. And a colleague of mine, Eyal Rosemarin, he's a brilliant psychoanalyst. We were just chatting the other day, and he says, I think we got disconnected from, you know, he says, you live a life and you rationalize every step, you know, and you know, okay, well, so my job is this, and now I have to work this many hours. Okay, so I get to the next level, I'll do this. And you rationalize a life and all of the things that life takes from you.
Right.
You know, and then we were just shot out of that.
Right.
Which was strange. And then to go back, nobody understands why they're doing anything. You don't even understand sometimes why you go to a dinner party.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the thing that, of course, I'm always, you know, posing the questions, whatever the issues are, is what to do. And I am constantly encouraging people to reach out, to go to in-person events. And it's amazing the resistance. You know, we've gotten, you know, safe in quotes in our comfort zones in quotes that are really typically very unsafe and are hardly the comfort zones that people would like to believe that they're, you know, that they're in. There's a bit, I see a fear, an uncomfortableness in really veering out of people's apartments, especially if they are working from home, the kind of conversation, the kind of communication, people are unsure. I see people, especially around here on the Upper West Side, I mean, people don't dress, walk around as if you just kind of got out of bed. And again, that's not a judgment. It's just what I am observing. And we in our roles as therapists are certainly trying to motivate and inspire people to get out of that box, because it's certainly not a box that's in their best interest. But I'm finding tremendous resistance for making that pivot, for making that change. And are you seeing that as well?
I definitely see that. I mean, I think that we haven't even begun to have a conversation. It's as if we try to pretend things are normal, and then we can't find our way back. So then we retreat back into our house and our pajamas and our bed and our computer.
Right.
And I sort of, you know, it was a real relief when I was just talking with my friend, and he said, nothing makes sense. And I said, that's right. I try to go out at night and then I go home and I feel exhausted and I don't know why. And I don't know why I resented going to that dinner party. I used to love
right.
it.
Right.
And so we need to begin to speak to each other from this place, not pretend that everything's going to go back to normal, not, you know, run away, but at least start to connect with the fact that, you know, we can't just mime our old lives somehow. Because I sort of feel like I've been doing that the last year. I'm like, okay, go to dinner parties, go see your friends. But yeah. I do it because it's important and it's good to have human connections, but something's not right. So I wish we could talk to each other more about that.
It's so interesting that you're saying this. I had this very conversation with my husband this morning. He's a sociologist, and we had these intense conversations. And this was my morning conversations, kind of going through the motions. And I'm a person that I don't want to go through the motions. You know, yeah. If I need to sort of perform, if I'm doing a TV show, okay, fine. But in my day-to-day life, that's not the way I want to be. And yet I'm, just as you're saying, going to a dinner party, or I found even going to synagogue, something is off. And I'm not sure exactly what it is. And I need to find out, because I'm not feeling the kinds of connections.
Yeah.
I wanted to, you know, when I read your article, I thought, you know what, you would be a really cool person that I would want to meet. And that was why I reached out to you, because mostly on the show, I don't have a lot of guests. And I just, there was something about the writing, there was just something about you that I thought, yes. And maybe part of it also, when I think about it, was wanting a connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And not just doing.
I'm so glad to meet you.
Yeah. No, I would love to meet you when you get back, you know, to actually get dressed, go out, do something, and continue on with the conversation.
Well, that makes me happy. You know, there are a couple of people who did it. The Molly Jong Fast, the reporter and journalist, writer, she said, "We got to meet." And I said, well, that's very forward. And she said, sorry, not sorry, which I thought was very funny. And so we met. I thought she was wonderful. And so I'm glad that there's something about bringing back this question of desire, bringing back the state of confusion we're in, and also what it means to really know what's in your heart, made a few really good people reach out to me, like you. So thank you.
Well, and that's the thing. And when I reached out, I mean, one never knows, you know, how people are going to respond, if people are going to respond. And this is the thing that, you know, I try to continue to inspire and motivate people, is that we have to keep trying. We have to keep trying, regardless of what yesterday's outcome was. And I think that what I'm finding is, whether it's in, you know, relationships or looking for relationships, is that I'm sensing this giving up. It hasn't worked out, so it's probably not going to work out. So why should I try again? Because it's just been a disappointment. And how to keep people motivated and inspired to really stay in the game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I think a lot of people are giving up on the apps. But it might open them now to finding different ways to run into people, meet people. I don't know. I hear more and more, you know, somehow you get off the app, you go through a period where you just say, I don't know, I'm just going to live my life. I'm not going to do this anymore. And then, you know, then they meet someone. So I, you know, it's not going to be everybody, but that's my hope. It's that you have to detox from the app. And then at a certain point, you'll remember again how to meet people out in the world.
You know, exactly. Well, listen, I am really so glad that we have connected. And when you're back, I promise. And, you know, people say, I'm going to call, I'm going to email, and you never hear from them again. But when you get back, I'll give yourself a couple of weeks and I'll reach out and let's meet in person and have a conversation.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Davison Webster. We'll be in touch soon, okay? Take care. Enjoy Cyprus. Bye-bye. This is the thing, you know, we need to be willing to take risks. You know, here was this psychoanalyst, New York clinical professor, and I really loved the piece that she wrote in the New York Times. And I remember thinking, this is exactly the kind of woman who I think that I would like to connect with. I didn't know whether or not she was going to respond. I didn't know whether or not we would be able to have an interesting conversation. But I think it really is about taking some risks, because if we sit at our computers and if we are looking at our phones, and I think that I had found that the statistics for teenagers, somewhere around 6 to 9 hours a day are spent looking the phones, checking the phones. Now, I'm not even sure checking for what. Maybe checking for a hope for connection with somebody. I know that so many of the younger people that I treat are on the phones playing games, all kinds of games. Now, I'm not a game player, so it's very, very difficult, you know, for me to relate to somebody who's spending hours and hours and hours playing video games. And I think the other thing, too, I mean, there is so much information on the internet that we can just spend, you know, days and weeks. And yet the basics really do hold true. What is it about? It is about love. It is about connection. It is about keeping ourselves healthy and exercising. And as I was mentioning to Jameson Webster when I was writing the column about the Blue Zone and looking at what are the people in the so-called happiest countries in the world, what are they doing and what can we actually learn from them? And their lives seem to be pretty basic. There were no extravaganzas. You know, people, they had their friends. There was a lot of socializing. There was a lot of family connection. People walked. They moved. They were out in nature. They ate well. They slept. They didn't sleep 2 hours a night, and where they were getting up in the middle of the night and watching, you know, videos, you know, online. There seemed to be a certain kind of a structure that these societies really all shared. And I think that another message that I'm hoping to be able to really, you know, get you to think about is getting out of your comfort zone. If you're feeling lonely, if you're feeling disconnected, whether or not you're looking for a love relationship or whether or not you are looking for some friends, the very, very best thing that you can do is take yourself out of your houses and your apartments and put down your phones and your various different devices and get yourself dressed and put yourself together so that you're going to look great and go somewhere. I mean, there are lectures, there are churches, there are synagogues, there are mosques. And if you don't happen to be somebody who is religious, there are non-sectarian organizations where people actually congregate and they actually talk. There are book signings. There are lectures on a variety of different subjects. Again, it's about getting yourself out of a comfort zone that is not working for you. You know, for those of you who listen to the Ask Beauty Show every single week, you know that I have a How Are You Doing segment. And I ask you the same questions every single week about your mental health. And if your depression, your anxiety, your substance abuse, if you find that you are going around in circles and that things aren't working, again, today is a new day. Every day we have an opportunity to do something differently, to do something if things aren't working, to find another path, to find another way, to find another therapist, to find another coach. I mean, I had a man call me on the Ask Beauty show a couple of weeks ago, and he was telling me that he's been in therapy with this person for years and years. And the first thing he said to me was that the therapy isn't working. And I said, well, are you planning or have you been planning to find another therapist? Well, it didn't quite dawn on him that he was a free agent. And yes, if something is not working in your therapeutic relationship, in your friend relationship, in your love relationship, in your work relationship, again, you have to give yourself permission to pivot. We don't need to stay in relationships that are not working, that are not in our best interest. And I know how easy it is. We get into the zone. It's a very, very familiar zone where it is difficult. It is difficult to envision that things can be different. But again, it's about really being honest with yourself. If things are working, then obviously you are doing the things that you need to do, that you are living a positive, happy, and joyful life. And of course, you know, having said that, I mean, we all go through a lot of ups and downs. So not every day, not every moment is going to be joyful and happy. But again, if you're finding that despite what it is that you're doing, that you are not where you would like to be, the question really then becomes, what are you willing to do? Because time goes by, my friends, and we can continue to go around in circles and complain about the same things all the time. And at some point, we need, with help or without help, hopefully, most people have some support, some friends' support, some family support, hopefully a combination where they are not going to feel so alone and so lonely in their journey to try to make some changes. But if that is not your situation, again, I really, and I've been saying this for years and years and years, to give yourself permission and reach out and get some good professional help. And there are agencies where they function on a sliding scale basis. And as I tell my own patients, you know, be open to negotiating fees. I think a lot of people are very intimidated when they see a therapist or when they see a doctor or a lawyer, and we're reluctant to ask for what we want. Now, maybe it's not going to work out at all, but I know that in my practice, I'm very open to talking with patients about adjusting fees. And I think it's just very, very important for me to encourage you to speak up, whether or not it's with a therapist or a doctor or a lawyer or a parent or a friend or a spouse or a lover. Because in avoiding and in denying and in not communicating our real feelings and where we are really at about a variety of things, we're operating, you know, when you think about it, in a really, really dishonest kind of way. We are not being honest. And how do we have meaningful connections and great relationships if we are holding back and saying yes when we really mean no? Well, my friends, it is 3:57 here in still rainy New York City, and I want to wish all my Jewish friends and family a wonderful Shana Tova, a wonderful, wonderful, healthy and happy and prosperous and connected Jewish new year. And whether or not you're Jewish or not, I still wish all of you a healthy and happy and prosperous new year. And of course, really a day-to-day life. That's what we all need to want and wish for each other. And in doing so, we would certainly be able to help create a much more loving and connected society. So I want to leave you with my two weekly messages. The first, of course, is to make sure that you are doing everything possible to be living your life in ways that are really in your best interest. And I think it's important to self-monitor and make sure that we are on track. And if we are not, then we need to pivot and find a way to get back on a good constructive path. And secondly, of course, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to love each other, respect each other's differences, despite race, individually and society-wise, and it just creates a much, much, much better way for all of us to live on a day-to-day basis. So again, thank you so much for listening, as you all do every single Monday live on the Ask Beattie Show here in New York City. And I will talk with you next week, and enjoy the rest of the day. Be good to yourself, and remember to love each other. Bye-bye, everybody.